Now, there are some conflicts that are so severe that even client consent won't let it happen. And representing a buyer and seller is a good example in a business context. All right, so what are some of the cumbersome issues in joint representation? Well, first off, who speaks for the client? You've got five people in a room, homeowners association, group of people forming a business, whatever. Who speaks for them? Well, everybody speaks for themselves. There is no deputized speaker. It requires unanimity. The problem with joint representation is everybody is the client. Who listens? Well, everybody listens. If you give notice to one of them, you got to give notice to everybody. In a joint representation, everybody is the client. Who acts for the client? Everybody. Hence the problem. See, that's the joint representation conundrum. It's fragile. That is, the minute one party says no, the representation ends, and there is no middle ground, the lawyer has to withdraw. The minute there's a disagreement among joint representation, the ethics rules just lay it bare. The lawyer's in a dilemma, and they have to stop. That's why all these engagement letters are so important to setting this notion forward. And then the minute somebody raises their hand and says, I object to this proceeding, to this meeting, to this consultation, and the lawyer says, okay, I'm quitting, then everybody in the room becomes former clients to the lawyer. And therefore, there are lingering duties there with respecting the adverse interest of parties as a former client. And once the lawyer decides to end the representation, it doesn't make any difference whether the client consents. It's over. Now, that's joint representation. You see how fragile and difficult it is? It's amazing we do it as much as we do, really. It's just dangerous as all get out. But client consent and lawyer's judgment is what carries the day. But once we have an organization in place, Rule 112 gave us the ability to represent a group of people where they can resolve their differences inside the organization, inside the board of directors meeting, and so on. So there is an organized conflict resolution inherent in the organization, so the lawyer's not put in the difficult spot. The lawyer can look to the entity and be loyal to the entity and let the group inside of the entity resolve its conflicts and resolve its communications with each other. That is the beauty of 112. That's why it's such a breakthrough for us. Now, some groups are not formally organized. One of the great articles I've ever read was the ethics problems of representing a rock and roll band from inception to termination. It was just beautiful because it gets into all the chaos of an informal organization. So certain groups might be organized as a formal organization, a two-man, two-person LLC. But that doesn't necessarily mean they respect the formality of it. And they very likely might run it as an informal group, sort of abandoning the operating agreement. And this case out of California cited is where the court said the parties ignored the formalities to such a degree that the court ruled that they were not an organization, in fact. So you have the risk as a lawyer of are these entrepreneurial people that you're representing, are they not giving enough of a nod to the formality of the organization so that you, the lawyer, can represent the organization? It's conceptually complex because of your distinctive responsibilities as a lawyer representing the organization. Who is your client? The organization. The engagement letter so states. It's clear. Who do you take instructions from? Well, the organization is a fictional entity. Therefore, you have to take it from people, the constituents, the officers, directors, people who run the company. Now, if there's a conflict of interest, who prevails when you represent an organization? When a remedial action has to be taken, against one of the constituents, who's going to protect the entity? That's what we're going to talk about here today. When the interest of the constituent diverge from the loyalty to the organization, what does the lawyer do? Now, 112 is the rule. And in prior last year, we talked about 112A, which is the fundamental rule, a lawyer may represent the organization. It is the rest of the rule, B, C, D, and E, that we're going to spend time on today. And there is a nest of intrigues in the rest of 112. And of course, you realize and appreciate that these rules are negotiated. They're heavily negotiated. They're drafted by committee. Supreme Court oversees it. It is not fictional reading. It's heavy-duty stuff. And there are a lot of other rules involved. You've got these conflicting duties, and it's not conflicting, but supplemental duties that are impacting the lawyer as they get into representing the loyalty to the organization, such as the scope of your engagement. It's going to come up constantly today. What is the scope of your representation? 1.5, we mentioned that briefly, the confidentiality. It's the overarching rule. It's one of the core principles. Comes up all the time. Conflict of interest, we've talked about that. And then finally, declining or withdrawing from representation. At the end of the day, we'll talk about how do you get out of this mess if you just can't go any further. There's a little more complexity to that than meets the eye. And then 303, candor to the tribunal if you're in a administrative or judicial setting. And then the truthfulness of statements to others. So the lawyer is confronted with a lot of things coming at them from different directions, and threading through this in a conflict situation.